Coming Home.
A ship of Adramyttium. Adramyttium is on the coast of Mysia, that's in the northern part of the peninsula of Asia Minor. It was bound for the different ports in Asia Minor. It probably was a homeward bound ship, because very few ships from Palestine in those days were bound for Italy. They usually had to sail north, and then they would catch a ship that would go westward on the Mediterranean toward the Italian ports. We have ships of Adramyttium as well. Seldom do we start out for our home port. Our journey is very seldom a straight line from here to our reunion with the Heavenly Father. We often go in other directions first and need to be transferred to another ship that goes the right direction. We also, like this ship, wanted to sail near land because we don't like to get into the rough seas. We try to sail where it's safe. We try to be cautious in life. Our courage is not yet built up in the early part of our Christian life. You know, our journey begins at consecration. That's where our real journey home starts. And as we take that journey, we meet many of these experiences where we have timidity before we have courage. Paul was under the charge of Julius the centurion. There are three centurions in the Bible. We'll get to them. This was a just and good man. The other centurions in the New Testament were also just and good men. They seem to be among the more noble of the Romans. You got the centurion whose servant Jesus healed. And then you've got the centurion at the cross who acknowledged that Jesus was the Messiah. And of course you got Cornelius, who was another centurion that was very noble and the first Gentile Christian. We too have our Juliuses, those of the government that we're under the charge of. And Paul talks about this in Romans 13, verses 3 and 4. The rulers, our Juliuses, are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of their power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. For he is a minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid. For he beareth not the sword in vain. For he is a minister of God, a revenger, and execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. Now that may not always be true. We may find those rulers that are opposed to our position, those rulers who for political reasons want to oppose the truth or oppose that, but many others do not. There are many others who seek to govern rightly and justly. Even as in that time, there were the Neros, there were the Herods, there were those who opposed the Christianity and persecuted them to death, but there were also the Juliuses, those who enforced the law, who said, we want to enforce it justly and rightly. And I think we need to appreciate the Juliuses we have, even as I'm sure Paul appreciated, I'm almost going to say the friendship of this Julius. Julius seems to have taken a special interest in Paul. He notes him along the way and he protects him. We'll see that later as we come to other experiences of their journey. Paul's companions were Luke and Aristarchus. And Barclay notes an interesting thing about this. He said there's only one way. Remember, Paul was a prisoner. He doesn't have the right to just take who he wants on a trip. So there's only one way that Aristarchus could have accompanied Paul on his last journey. And that was by enrolling himself as Paul's slave, or you might read servant, bond servant. It is probable that Aristarchus chose to act as a slave of Paul rather than be separated from him. Loyalty can go no further than that. To make yourself a slave of another just to be with him, just to have his companionship. We as Christians have our traveling companions. We have hundreds of them. Throughout the world, we got thousands of them to travel with us. But are we willing to be their slaves? Are we willing to bond ourselves to them and to say, I will be with you and serve you and be a servant to you? Paul says in Hebrews 10, called remembrance the former days, in which after you were illuminated, you endured a great fight of afflictions, partly while you were made a gazing stock, both by reproaches and afflictions. But notice the last part. And partly while you became companions of them that were so used. Do we look out to be companions of those who are the abused among us? Of those who may be in less honor or less respect? Of those who may be on the sidelines? Are we willing to stick our neck out and be their companion? To be their slave because we want to travel with them to the promised land? This is the challenge to each of us in this lesson of Paul's journey. They get to Sidon, they meet the Sidonian brethren. On the following day, we put into Sidon, where Julius treated Paul most considerately by allowing him to visit his friends and accept their hospitality. Today, may not be forever, but today, favorable laws allow us the comfort and encouragement of business with our brethren. Today, favorable laws in our country permit this meeting. Let us gather together. In most countries today, in the world, that's true. It's not always been true. The brethren in Eastern Europe found the time when it was not. But being true, do we make the most of it? Do we really appreciate the blessings that we do have? Do we thank the Lord often for the Julius that permits our visiting our Sidonian brethren along the way? Now we'll follow the journey along as he goes from Caesarea onto Myra. This is verses 4 and 5. From Sidon, we put to sea again and sailed to the leeward of Cyprus. Since the winds were against us, then when we had crossed the gulf that lies off the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we arrived at Myra in Lycia. They were not yet involved in a storm, but the winds were contrary. And the same is true in our early Christian life. We have to learn to sail against the wind. And when we do, we hug the land for safety. We don't venture too far out yet. We're still new in our Christian walk. But right away we find out that our new course in life is not the course that's most popular to the world. The winds of circumstance blow the opposite direction, and we need to sail forward despite the burst winds. For a sailor, there is probably no circumstance that is more difficult to meet than the changing wind patterns. Today, when we have motorized ships, they can buck the winds, they can go against them. But then they had to sail very carefully when the winds were contrary. It was a very slow passage. And then when the wind would turn suddenly, they had to be alert to change the direction of the sails to meet the new wind patterns. And so there are shifting winds in our life, and many of them are adverse winds, and we need to learn to sail against the wind and sail upstream, as it were. Myra's in Lycia. The city itself was a cliffside seaport. This is a picture of the ruins of Myra as it is today. It means light. And Myra means myrrh or bitter. So you got quite a contrast in the town where they go to. Myra is also, myrrh is an ointment. In Revelation 10, verses 8 and 9, we read about the experience of the Christian. The voice which I heard from heaven spake unto me again and said, go and take the little book, which is open in the hand of the angel, which standeth upon the sea and upon the earth. And I went to the angel and said to him, give me the little book and eat it. It shall make thy belly bitter, but shall be in thy mouth sweet as honey. Whether we look at this as particularly the doctrine of the second presence of Christ, or all the truth, it has that mixed feeling in us. We get the light and we enjoy the light. We're thrilled by the light. It's a seaport to us. But at the same time, it often brings bitterness. It brings hard and sorrowful experiences. They come our way simultaneously with the light. They sail on to Crete. There the centurion found a ship of Alexandria, sending Italy. And he put us therein, and when we had sailed slowly many days, and scarce were come over against Critus, the wind not suffering us, we sailed under a Crete, over against Salmone, and hardly passing it, came into a place which is called the Fair Havens, near nigh whereunto was the city of Lycia. This is this journey portion of the journey from Myra down to Crete, the southern way to go. You notice how the ship path meanders toward Italy through the Mediterranean. and how they go to the leeward side of the islands, where they would have the blockade from the winds. Here they change ships, a ship of Alexandria, a larger ocean-going ship, one that could take the storms of the Mediterranean better than the ship of Antimitium, which was a small seaport, did not make the big ships, but ones that were aimed toward land, closer to land, bound for Italy, the promised land, carrying a cargo of grain. And other prisoners. We don't know how many other prisoners, but we do know that all in all, that ship had 276 passengers. Those were not huge ships, ocean liners we have today. These were sailing ships. But it's not unusual. In the historians, they tell of one ship of that time that had 600 passengers that went ashore. And that's probably the maximum of any of these ships that they had. But this was still a good-sized ship. And in addition to the passengers, remember, it had a full cargo of grain. Critias is not quite known. There are various opinions where Critias was. Some feel it was the southern tip of the peninsula that Myra is on, and others that it's an island quite a bit further south. That's sort of an important detail, but it's interesting to note the possibilities. How the ship has the protection of all these islands as it sails. So during this stage of the journey, it is never far from land. If there is a bad problem, it can get to land fairly easy. The winds forced a route south of Crete. Salmone is the tip on the very far eastern edge of the island of Crete. Fair Havens is the southernmost tip. So they're sailing around the south end. Evidently, the winds were northerly winds, because it was the island that blocked the winds from them and gave them the protection. That's why they sailed under Crete. They sailed where there was the protection of the winds by the land. Lycia was about 10 miles distant from Fair Havens. Fair Havens was a small fisherman's cove. It was not used to putting in large ships. It was mainly for fishing ships that would be on the Mediterranean, bringing their supplies in. And as a result, it was a small town, did not have a lot of places, stores, and inns for the sailors to stay. It was a rather small place. But it was near the larger town of Lycia. And that's probably mentioned because that's where they would go for supplies and get re-equipped for the rest of the journey. Undoubtedly, they stayed on ship, so they didn't need to have lodging there, but they did have a place to go for whatever they needed at that time. And they expected to spend a while there, and they did spend a while in Fair Havens. Let's look at our onward course. We too are driven by the contrary winds of life. We have to learn how to sail against the wind and keep maneuvering onward toward our homeward goal. We too still seek to be close to land, to have the shelter of any protection there is. This is common caution. This is not a lack of courage. It's pure wisdom in sailing. Christian too have our fair havens along the way. Places where there's a time after we sail against the wind where we can catch our breath, where we can refuel, as it were. I like to think of our conventions as fair havens, places we go to. Well, back in the early days in the truth movement, I remember the term was often used at conventions. This is your gasoline station. You're stopping to be refilled, to ready to go on to the next part of your journey. We often settle, though, into these fair havens and we say, I want to stay here a while. Our comfort zones are there. I sort of think about that time when James and John went with Jesus to the Mount of Transfiguration. And they said, oh, this is wonderful. Let's build 3 tabernacles and stay here. That's what we want to do at our fair havens. We want to stay for a while. But the Apostle Paul has an admonition to give them. When much time was spent, they spent quite a while there at fair havens, and when sailing was now dangerous, because the fast was already past, Paul admonished them. And we want to notice in this verse that he gives us a timing of this journey, when the fast was already past. It is generally assumed that this fast was the fast of atonement, which would put it in mid-September, that when this fast was over, that they were ready to go on. This enters into the stormy season in the Mediterranean. That's when the wintry winds begin coming in, and they have what's called the Northeasters. and they're going to get caught in the Northeaster a little later. For the Christian, we need to fast before we go on. We need to have much prayer and fasting. And I think particularly the fast of atonement. Excuse me. The Day of Atonement was not only a fast time, but it was also a time for repentance. It was a time to express the sorrow for the sins and prepare for the road ahead. We need to do that for our own case. We get our comfort zones. We need to come to the Lord and say, Lord, if I have done wrong, please show me the better way. Have the correct path. Because when we go on, we're going to get into more open seas, close to land. Our homeward goal lies across the ocean itself. But it may have been a different fast. Brother Russell suggests in reprint 4505 that they were delayed until about October 1st, the Jewish New Year's Day, and a fast day, and the time for equinoctial storms. Actually, these two are almost simultaneous. The New Year's Day was the first of the month, and the Day of Atonement was the 10th. So you're only 10 days apart. Either of these would be about the same. But New Year suggests a little another experience for the Christian, and that is, we have a new year, a new start for life. We need to go on from our comfort zone. Paul admonished them. Paul said, sirs, I perceive, and notice the word perceive, that this voyage will be with hurt and much damage, not only of the lading and the ship, but also of our lives. Nevertheless, the centurion believed the master and the owner of the ship more than those things which were spoken by Paul. Paul gives a word of caution. He said, if we go on in the stormy weather, we're not going to make it. The ship can get bound. Better we stay here in the fair haven. It's as though Paul, who is usually the bold, the one who steps out in faith, is urging, in this case, hold back. Don't go out. Don't tempt faith. And he says this from his perceptions. I perceive. Barnes says he might have perceived it from his own knowledge of the danger of navigation at the autumnal equinox, and from what he saw of the ship as unfitted to a dangerous navigation. But there is nothing that should prevent our believing that he was also guided to this conclusion by the inspiration of the Spirit of God. You know, the verse did not say that Paul received a vision from God telling him, ship's going to do this, or that he spoke because he was inspired, but he perceived it. He was able to look at the signs around him and draw a conclusion from his deductions, and then from that conclusion, give the advice that he gave. Man can be overconfident. Remember the Titanic. It took professionals to build the Titanic. Amateurs built the Ark. And it was the Ark that survived, not the Titanic. We need to evaluate the risks in life. Paul evaluated the conditions. He opted for a cautious recommendation. Christians are to be courageous. We are to face the stormy winds. We're not to be afraid of the stormy winds. But we are not to be reckless. If we see that there is a perception that a certain course brings about a needless danger, then there's a time for the admonition to caution. If we see that the mission to be accomplished is worth the danger, then the advice of the Christian is to proceed despite the dangers. If we are forced into the dangerous position, as Paul was, because the centurion believed the ship owner rather than Paul, then we are to put our full trust in the Lord for the balance of the journey. The storm comes upon them. Acts 27:12-16. And because the haven was not commodious to winter in, the more part, or the majority, advised to depart thence also, if by any means we might attain to Phoenice, and there to winter, which is an haven of Crete, and lieth toward the southwest and northwest. And when the south wind blew softly, supposing they obtained their purpose, loosing thence, they sailed close by Crete. But not long after, there rose against it a tempestuous wind called the Euroclydon. And when the ship was caught, and could not bear up into the wind. We let her drive. And running on a certain island, which is called Clauda, we had much work to come by the boat. A lot of interesting things in this passage. We note that we have confirmation that Fair Havens was not a large port. It was not commodious enough to winter in. In winter, it would be not comfortable on the ship. They would need to seek inns. So they said we should go on. After all, right now the winds are favorable. The north wind has stopped. We're getting a south wind. It's blowing softly. And we can keep our journey on. We can at least get to Phoenice. Phoenice wasn't that far. It was just the end of the island. You may have seen that map that we saw earlier, where Phoenice is located at the end. And Clauda, just off the coast of Phoenice. So they were sailing sort of between Clauda and Phoenice. That was where they were coming to in this part of the journey. Tranquil seas are allure. We can often find them leading us into needless temptations. The adversary sometimes will give us a nice soft wind and say, now you proceed out. Don't worry. And then he follows through with his number 1-2 punch, which is the arachnidons of life. Once the arachnidon hit, they were driven from shore and driven out to the open sea by the typhoon. And the word tempestuous winds there in the Greek word is typhoon. It was that typhoon that hit. So they decided to embark for Italy because they're on the high seas anyway. They were through this long stretch. They have the biggest, most dangerous part of the journey to go through in the most dangerous part of the year, all the way from Point 5, which is actually Fair Havens, or Clauda really, on down, almost touching Africa, and then sailing on till they get to this little island of Malta down here, which we'll talk about later. I don't know why I point here. You can't see where I'm pointing, but I know where I'm pointing. The storm arises. The arachnidon. Some of you may have seen the film Perfect Storm, and this is from that film. Sometimes because we don't heed the state caution, we go out where we court disaster and lose control. So the ship was driven by itself. They had no longer control over it. They couldn't tack to the winds. To let her drive means to be borne by the wind, uncontrolled. Just let the ship go where it will because they couldn't control it, to find out where fate would lead them. When they had taken up, they used helps, undergirding the ship, and fearing lest they should fall into the quicksands, strake sail, and so were driven. And we being exceedingly tossed with a tempest, the next day they lightened the ship. The third day we cast out with our own hands the tacking of the ship. And when neither sun nor stars in many days appeared, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope that we should be saved was then taken away. This is one of those places I'm going to divert from a main lesson and a basic picture I'm using to another picture, because I've always appreciated the comments that Brother Russell mentions about saving the ship of state. There are four steps they use to save the ship. The first day, they undergirded the ship. That is, they cast ropes or chains around the hull of the ship to hold it together. Usually when they do this, they have about 11 chains that they put at different places around to hold a ship of this size together. It's quite a tedious job. It needs to be done someplace where they've got at least the ability to be on quiet sea for a short time, because you can't do this in a very storm wind. So they evidently, the tempest had let down a little bit, and they prepared for it by undergirding the ship with these cables. Also on the first day, they lower the sails, because the sails would get torn apart in the wind. Seeing it was coming, we just rip it apart and say, better let the ship go where it will. We won't try to guide the ship at this stage. We'll let it float. The second day, they jettison the surplus supplies. They lighten the ship. They get rid of all the things they did not need, they didn't feel a need of. Remember, they kept the cargo. They can get rid of that, because that was their job, was to bring that safely to land. And they kept the more important supplies. But the third day, they jettisoned even the excess sails and the ropes, They put in jeopardy any future plans for the ship. They went through four different steps in trying desperately to save the ship. It always makes you think of the time when Jonah was on that ship, and they tried to save Jonah's ship. They went through similar procedures to try to save it. The last resort they wanted was to throw anybody overboard until Jonah was willing to go. Rather, Russell suggests in some of his writings, there are four things that a wise government can do to save the ship of state. The first step is strengthen the government itself, undergird the ship. Have the government be able to act positively in situations. But the second is to loosen the tight controls over the people, to not try to hold the people down, but to give them the freedoms. In the second volume, he writes about the Elias chapter, that how much wiser it would be if they would recognize the needs of the undertrodden and of the have-nots and begin fulfilling these needs rather than continuing to repress them. The third is to eliminate the excesses of government, to throw overboard that which they don't need, until finally they're forced to jeopardize even their future needs and to throw over everything in order to have the possibility of saving the ship of state. It says, because they fear the quicksands. You don't usually associate quicksand with oceans. Usually quicksand is a dry land phenomenon. But this is not true of these quicksands. The Greek word is styre. And even today, there are two styre that are noted in geography. The major styre and the minor styre. One is off the coast of Tunisia, and the other is off the coast of, what's that A country just to the west of Tunisia? Angola?
Algeria.
Thank you, Richard. It slipped my mind. These are caused by the winds coming north off of the Sahara, and they blow the sand of the Sahara into the ocean, and this causes the sand to be mixed with the water and become very dangerous to the ship. It's like a shoal, only instead of being a rock, the shoal was of sand. And the ship gets caught in this, and then is battered by the winds, and they have no control. So it's a totally moored position. They're always shifting, too, because the winds shift. And so the quicksand may be in one location, and they can't chart it, because it can move to another location as the winds shift the sand coming in. We have our quicksands in life. They are caused also by the blowing winds of affliction and the dust of our Saharas, the dust of this world, the worldly influences coming to our lives and becoming submerged where they can easily trap us and hold us down. These become the snares that so easily beset us, the close girding sin that can come upon us. And unfortunately, these two are constantly shifting. We think we've plotted our course, we've found a way to avoid this temptation in life, and another temptation opens up in another direction. One way or another, we are afraid, naturally afraid, of the quicksands that are out there that can moor us and keep us from reaching our desired haven. And so when neither star, sun, S-U-N, sorry, nor star has appeared, in Job 23:28-9, we have this thought of neither the sun nor the stars appearing in our life. Job said, I go forward, but God is not there. Backward, I cannot perceive him. On the left hand where he doth work, but I can't behold him. He hides himself on the right hand that I cannot see him. Brethren, do you ever come to the place in your life where you can't trace God's hand? You don't know why I'm in this experience, and you feel bogged down with experience, and you get this feeling of Job that says, whatever direction I go, wherever I look, there is no way out. Of course, Job forgot to look one direction. He didn't look up. That's the only place there's a way out. When we find ourselves in this position, we need to look up, and then we'll find all is not dark. The next verse is it, but God knoweth the way that I take. When he has tried me, I shall come forth as gold. To have that positive faith, that assurance, that trust, that says, I can't trace him, but I trust him. Paul's prophecy, Acts 27:21 to 26. But after a long abstinence, lack of food, Paul stood forth in the midst of them and said, "Sirs, you should have hearkened to me." Put in our terms, why didn't you listen? I told you so. "And not have loosed from Crete, and to have gained this harm and loss. But now, since you've done it, I exhort you to be of good cheer, for there shall be no loss of any man's life among you, but of the ship. For there stood by me this night the angel of God, whose I am, and whom I serve, saying, 'Fear not, Paul, thou must be brought before Caesar, and lo, God hath given thee all them that sail with thee. Wherefore, sirs, be of good cheer, for I believe as it was that as was told me. Howbeit, we must be cast upon a certain island.'" This reminds me of a story Brother Norby told once. He was flying from the west coast to the east, and they hit a big lightning storm over Pennsylvania, and the plane just rocked and shook, and even the stewardess were getting concerned. And they got there, and as he was getting off, the stewardess said, "We made it." And Brother Norby said, "I knew we made it. My God was in charge of the plane." He had that faith that no matter what the outward dangers were, that he had that assurance in his mind that he would be brought safely through. And so Paul, in this case, no longer acts by any perception. He acts because he has seen an angel of God. Now he's got inspiration to back up his point. And the point is that having gotten into this case, we shouldn't have gotten into it, but having gotten into it, don't worry. All will be saved because of me. And you know, that's so true. The entire world will be saved because of you. Because you are the Lord's, and the Lord has promised to bring you through. And for that reason, he's also going to bring all mankind through. Peter says in 1 Peter 1:9, "Receiving the end of your faith, even the salvation of souls, all are saved because of the church." We know, no question, an angel of the Lord has told us, we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are called according to his purpose. And again, let your conversation be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have. For he said, "I will never leave thee nor forsake thee." Or to put it very literally from the Greek, "I will never, never leave you. I will not, I will not, I will not let you down." Five negatives in the Greek to emphasize God's care for the church. Finally, they spot land. They're nearing the critical part. On the 14th night of the storm, as we were drifting on the Adriatic, about midnight, the sailors sensed that we were nearing land. Indeed, when they sounded, they found 20 fathoms. And then after sitting on only a little way, they sounded again and found 15 fathoms. So, for fear that we might be hurled on the rocks, they threw out four anchors from the stern, and we prayed for daylight. They recognized that the land was coming so fast that there might be shoals there, and they couldn't see with dark at night. And so they said, "Put down four anchors to hold the ship safe where we are until we can see, and then we can lift the anchors and sail between the shoals." Where they had arrived was this island just off the coast of Greece, the island of Malta. They had fear of rocks. They sensed land not only by the fathoms, but a sailor is trained to the sounds of surf. He knows when the waters, rolling waters, show a lessening depth of the ocean. Noting the shallow waters, they anchor the ship steadily because fear paralyzed them. They had to say, "We're afraid to go on now. We don't know if we can get through this at night. We don't have any running lights, especially not in a storm, to be able to get through." Don't abandon ship. That was Paul's counsel. Now is the place where it's the most dangerous, and it's going to be a natural temptation for you to abandon ship. That's just what they started to do. The sailors wanted to desert the ship, And they got as far as letting a boat down into the sea, pretending that they were going to run out anchors from the bows. But Paul said to the centurion, the soldiers, unless these men stay aboard the ship, there is no hope of being saved. At this, the soldiers cut the ropes of the boat and let the lifeboats fall away. Then while everybody waited for the day to break, Paul urged them to take some food, saying, for 14 days now you've had no food. You haven't had a bite while you've been on watch. Can you imagine the energy that was required to maintain that ship? The hard work, the calories they burn up. And despite that, for 14 days they didn't eat. These were men, they may have been pagans, but they feared the danger. As they say, in the foxhole there are no atheists. They were fasting. They were hoping. They were looking for some way out of the salvation. And Paul says, you're going to need every bit of strength you got. Eat. Take some food and be ready for the journey. Take some food, I beg you. You need it for your survival. I assure you, not a hair of anyone's head will be lost. And when he said this, he took some bread. And after thanking God before them all, he broke it and began to eat. This raised everybody's spirit. And they began to take food themselves. There were about 276 of us all told aboard that ship. So he said, break out the food. And they were still hesitant. But then Paul set the example. And he goes, first thing he does, he gives thanks. In the middle of a storm, give thanks. That is the time that we know that we have deliverance, because we know that whatever happens, whether we sink or whether we swim, our salvation is assured if we have our faith steady in our Lord. But the sailors sought to save their own lives. Christians must trust while others panic. We must have the attitude of saying, yes, take heed, take strength for the day, be prepared for what comes. We need to eat the bread of truth. Because they had complete belief in the precious promise of the Lord. But you notice, brethren, how many of those precious promises are conditional. We looked at one recently at our Thursday day study. Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on thee. If we do our part, God will be sure to do his part. And we should encourage others. We should say that this is not the end. This trouble you see about you, the great time of trouble, the wars, the Iraqs, the Afghanistans of this world, the Liberias of this world, they are not going to endanger God's plan. We can give you encouragement. Eat, because not one of your heads, hairs of your head, will be brought down. Paul thanked God for the food, and the eating of it raised their spirits and encouraged others to do the same. They needed the nourishment for the times of distress. Then landfall. When they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship. They already lightened it, getting rid of the sails and other things. Now they threw the grain into the sea. When daylight came, no one recognized the land. But they made out a bay with a sandy shore where they planned to beach the ship if they could. So they cut away the anchors and left them in the sea, and at the same time unleashed the ropes which held the steering oars. Then they hoisted the foresail to catch the wind and made for the beach. But they struck a shoal and the ship ran aground. The bow stuck fast, and while the stem began to break up under the pounding of the waves, the soldiers' plan had been to kill the prisoners in case any of them should try to swim to shore and escape. But the centurion, in his desire to save Paul, put a stop to this and gave orders that all those who could swim should jump overboard first and go to land, while the rest should follow, some on planks, others on the wreckage of the ship. And so it came true that everyone, 276 people, reached the shore in safety. This is what that opening paragraph from Brother Russell talks about. We need to come to the final shipwreck, where our ship goes down, but our salvation has come through the shipwreck of it. We need to jettison even that cargo we're carrying for earthly gain. Earthly loss is necessary for heavenly gain, to get rid of the grain that was there. Safety can only be reached by wrecking the earthly vessel. Divine providence alone can effect the ultimate salvation. But Julius intervenes on Paul's behalf. And so, looking back, when all are saved, we'll praise the way that God has led us day by day.